भगवते वासुदेवाय।
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 3, Text 23, Chapter entitled Liberation from the Illusory Energy. Sarvatah manasah asangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha bhuteshu adha yatha uchitam sarvato manaso sangam adau sangam cha swadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha bhuteshu adha yochitam sarvato manaso sangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha bhuteshu adha yathochitam sarvato manaso asangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha bhuteshu adha yathochitam sarvato manaso sangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha sarvato manaso asangam adau sangam cha sadhushu adhayoti chucham sarvato manaso sangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashayam cha bhuteshu adhayathochitam sarvata manaso sangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashayam cha bhuteshodha yathochitam. Ladies, sarvata manaso sangam adau sangam cha sadhushu dayam maitrim prashrayam cha bhuteshu adha yathochitam. Sarvatah, everywhere, manasah, of the mind, asangam, detachment, adav, in the beginning, sangam, association, cha, and sadhushu, with saintly persons, dayam, mercy, maitrim, friendship, prashayam, reverence, cha, and bhuteshu, for all living beings, adha, thus, yathachitam, as is suitable. Translation purport by the disciple of Srila Prabhupada. A sincere disciple should learn to dissociate the mind from everything material, and positively cultivate association with his spiritual master and other saintly devotees. He should be merciful to those in an inferior position to him, cultivate friendship with those on an equal level, and meekly serve those in a higher spiritual position. Thus he should learn to deal properly with all living beings. Purport. We shall read half the purport and half will be discussed tomorrow. Srila Madhavacharya has quoted from the Garuda Puran to demonstrate that within this universe, those who take birth as demigods, great rishis, or pious human beings are all considered santaha or saintly persons. According to Bhagavad Gita, Traigunya Vishaya Vedaha, the Varnashram culture described in Vedic literature deals mostly with the living entities who are struggling within the three modes of nature. The Vedic literatures teach such conditioned souls that material happiness can be achieved only through pious works. In this sense, the demigods are to be considered the most pious living entities within the three modes of material nature. The rishis or the great saintly mystics of the universe were able to travel at will at various places, and who cultivate mystic powers are to be considered a little somewhat below the demigods. And those human beings on earth who perfectly execute the Vedic rituals are to be considered in the third or lowest category of santaha or saintly persons. But a devotee of the Lord is beyond the three modes of material nature. Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 14.26, Mam chayova vicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samati yaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus becomes to the level of Brahman. Thus Lord Krishna clearly says that a Vaishnava who does not fall down from the regulations of Bhakti Yoga is beyond the three modes of nature. And Lord Krishna advises Arjun, a Krishna Bhakta, to transcend the three material qualities of the illusory creation of Maya. Naistraigrunya Bhava Arjuna. But in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, 18.40, the Lord says, Natad ashti prithvim yamva divi deve shuva punaha sattvam prakritir jair muktam yad ebhi syatribhir gunai. There is no being existing either here or among the demigods in the half-planetary systems who is free from the three modes of material nature. Thus the demigods are not exempt from the pollution of the three modes of material nature. Whereas a pure devotee actually becomes gunatita or transcendental to the influence of Maya. Om Agyana Timirandhasya Gnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam పరిజనా సహితం కృష్ణ చైతన్య దేవం శ్రీరాధా కృష్ణ పాదాన్ సహగణాలలితా శ్రీ విశాఖాన్వితాంశ్చ హే కృష్ణ కరుణా సింధు దీనబంధు జగత్పతే గోపేశ గోపికా కాంత రాధాకాంత నమోస్తుతే తప్త కాంచనా గౌరాంగీ రాధే వృందావనేశ్వరి వృషభానుసుతే దేవీ ప్రణమామి హరి ప్రియే వాంఛాకల్పతరుభ్యశ్చ కృపాసింధుభ్య ఏవ చ పతితానాం పావనేభ్యో వైష్ణవేభ్యో నమో నమః శ్రీకృష్ణ చైతన్య ప్రభు నిత్యానంద శ్రీ అద్వైత గదాధర శ్రీవాసది గౌరభక్తవృంద కృష్ణ హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరే 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 రామ 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 హరే హరే Since a disciple should learn to dissociate the mind from everything material and positively cultivate association with his spiritual master and other saintly devotees, he should be merciful to those in an inferior position to him, cultivate friendship with those who are on equal level, and meekly serve those in a higher spiritual position. Thus, he should learn to deal properly with all living beings. The discussion is on between the illustrious Rajarshi King Maharaj Nimi and the now Yogendras. This question answers are going on between specifically Prabuddha of the one of the nine now Yogendras was discussing with the king, and all of them basically are dealing with this basic subject of liberation from the illusory energy. This chapter is labeled like this, illusory liberation, illusory energy, but actually the entire, not only this chapter, but the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, or the entire Bhagavad Gita for the matter, or for the matter every Bhakti Shastra is all about this subject. All the processes which we learn in our curriculum within the realm of our Krishna Conscious Training Program is for this subject, how to get liberated from the illusory energy and achieve Param Padam, that is the perfection of liberation, which is the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. So here in this purport which we just read, the mention is made about, and the sloka, the focus of the sloka is about the mind. And obviously quite importantly, because the mind is the focus for every practicing yogi. Whatever type of yogi he is, karma yogi, jnana yogi, dhyana yogi, bhakti yogi, his focus, what he deals with, what is the apparatus which he is supposed to manipulate, is ultimately the mind. Therefore, it's all about the journey within. Why is it called the journey within? Because the mind is within. So everything we learn is supposed to ultimately help us, whether we can say modulate or manipulate, or the better word probably would be transform the mind. This sloka talks about two specific things which we need to do. One is saying dissociate, other is saying associate. That means this sloka talks simultaneously about two parallel activities to be done together. It's telling us, it's urging us to learn, to meditate deeply on detaching ourselves, dissociating ourselves with all that is material. and we'll talk about what is material a few minutes later. It is also urging us to connect, to associate, to do sangha. The word sangha has come here. With two people, the spiritual master and the saintly devotees of Krishna. This becomes a very balanced approach. Only detachment or only dissociation with material nature, material activities, put us in the category of jnanis or impersonalist or yogis who have no positive connection. And if you are to only connect with devotees and at the same time not release the anchor of association with the material nature, we won't go too far. We know the story of Saraswati Thakur's sailing of this boat, throwing of this boat, the marriage party. We heard that before, right? Saraswati Thakur talks about the story of how the marriage party started in the night. And the boatman was there, said, okay, your marriage is tomorrow morning. The bridegroom and all the party was there. And by the time they boarded the boat, it was quite late. Sun had already set. It was a moonless night. And he is rowing the boat. And of course, people are tired from their marriage preparations and everything else. And everyone just dozes off. As we all doze off in the second class compartment, you know, when we just sit. Tired. So, in the morning they get up and they find, to their utter surprise and amazement, that they have not moved even 1 foot away from the shore. And they immediately look, why this fellow has been walking the whole night? What has happened was something very foolish and yet very important to learn from. That he was rowing, he was doing a lot of hard work. He was rowing a boat. Anybody who's not rowing, I mean, you know, we go for sporting like boating and all. When you try to do that, holding two oars, it's pretty laborious, right? Even as a sport, when you do it for 15 minutes, someone has to massage your hands or take a brufen afterwards. But he was doing it the whole night. Nothing had moved. The anchor was not released. Major mistake was done. Right? So, we also, as practicing devotees who are rowing our boat, or rather we can say practicing our rituals of bhakti, if we are not simultaneously detaching ourselves, as is being urged by the sloka, and still doing our activities, it is going to be acting as a retarding force, a decelerating force. Like every car has an accelerator and a reverse gear and also a brake. There are three levels of a car. Right? So practicing bhakti yoga with sincerity of performing our sadhana bhakti is pressing accelerator, and yet keeping all our attachments of this world intact is acting like a reverse gear, and effectively it acts like a brake. You're pressing accelerator and reverse gear together, it acts like a brake. You don't go forward. Right? So that is something which is a major mistake. So when it says that we have to disconnect from everything material, what is it talking about? It is about disconnecting ourselves with material sense of consciousness. Therefore, it is not ashram specific that you give up these things. People in the saffron give up these things, people in the white give up these things. There's no mention of any ashram here. It's all about anyone and everyone who's on the path of bhakti. So, specifically, the checklist for all of us, whether the anchor is released or not, is important. While I'm practicing my bhakti yoga, how do I really know whether I'm practicing it still with retarding forces which take me to a reverse gear? Retarding forces specifically mentioned as words are the lower modes. The lower modes actually bring about retardation. The sattva guna brings about acceleration. Sattva guna takes us forward towards ultimately shuddha sattva. But rajoguna tamoguna act as retarding forces. the lower modes. And there's a constant struggle. Practically, this struggle is the only struggle of bhakti. There's no other struggle. When you think, come to think of it, what is the struggle we all of us are going through? It's only this struggle, nothing else. The urges created by the lower modes pulling us down, and the urges of bhakti impelled by inspiration given by the sadhus, spiritual masters, impelling us to go up. So they have technically called the higher self and the lower self. And between those two selves is the mind. The sandwich is the mind. Right? The body and senses together form the lower self. The intelligence and the soul put together form the higher self. And a sandwich in between, which is the most difficult part of sadhaka, is the mind. So where the mind gets gravitated towards is where you will go. Whether you are a devotee or not is irrespective. It's where your, as I say, you are where your mind is, right? We can be sitting in this class and thinking about, you know, what a child is doing at home or whatever. We can be thinking various things. So the mind, the more it connects to the body and senses, it is going to act as a retarding force. The mind, if it is governed by intelligence rooted in scripture, right, is going to take the mind upwards. Right? So mind can be made in that way the best friend when it is governed by the higher self, and the same mind can act as the worst enemy when it's governed by the lower selves, which is controlled by the body and the five senses. So what is it within the mind which determines whether we will be going gravitating downwards or evolving upwards? Specifically, there are four things which are like a mental checklist for all of us to know. And if we remain conscious of these four factors, we can actually manipulate, transform, modulate the mind effectively in the steering it to in the right direction. The four things we'll enumerate first, and we'll elaborate a little bit on each if possible. It's an extensive subject, but we can summarize. First, selfish desires. Second is anger. Third is fear. And fourth is lamentation. When the mind is absorbed in these four things, it is definitely going to gravitate towards a downward journey. The first, of course, is selfish desires. The example which always we can take for our learning process, we're all learning, we are students of bhakti yoga, is to always look at the example of Indra. Because Krishna has put Indra in such a strategic position where being a mixed devotee, which most of us actually are also, trying to go upwards, his example comes very stark and strong, very powerful in all Vedic literatures, especially in the Bhagavatam and the Puranas. It comes very strongly. Why? Because he's a prototype person. He's a prototype person of a person who is also a very exalted struggler on the path of bhakti. He has gained great heights in bhakti, and yet he is always challenged by selfish desires. He is challenged by, and when they are not fulfilled, he is challenged by his anger. And when that goes further, he experienced so much fear is there in Indra. And of course, he is struck so many times by lamentation. So these are the four symptoms of a person who is a mixed devotee. So therefore, we have to look at this very carefully. The more we identify with this body, the senses, the more exactly proportionate, scientifically exactly proportionate, is these four things will be high. We can look at it, we can analyze in our minds. the more a person is in the bodily considering things, he is a body and the senses, to that extent he'll have intensified selfish desires. He'll very frequently overcome by anger. He'll be in a state of always constant fear and have massive lamentation when he's not able to fulfill them exactly proportionately. So for us to know whether we're making progress or not is to see how much we are diluting off the influence of these within our mind. Right? The Bhakti Yoga process is so extremely powerful that it is a rapid progress to destroy all these four things all at once. Therefore, in our Chaitanya Charitamrita, for example, even people who are in the most lowest state of consciousness, states of consciousness which have never been experienced at the universal level at any point of time, the most degraded, lowest consciousness people have been shown to be transformed immediately through Bhakti Yoga. And that's our inspiration. The example given is of Chand Rai and Raghavendra Rai. Now, these are considered by Vrindavan Das Thakur as even more degraded than Jagai and Madai. Jagai and Madai themselves are like the benchmark of, like, nobody can, like, you have Olympics record, the fastest runner, the fastest bowler, the fastest swimmer, the fastest javelin thrower, fastest weightlifter. So the universal record is not a Guinness book, but whatever book, this even Vedic literature, the highest score, nobody was born in this universe who was more sinful than Jagai and Madai. And obviously they were born in Kali Yuga, the most conducive environment for practicing sin. And they are rated as the highest sinful beings in the creation. And yet, and of course we have to understand what that means. We know the whole story, but we sometimes underestimate what is described. When we hear about the scribes getting tired writing about, you know, or data feeding what is happening, what they are doing at every moment in the heavenly planets, the essence of Yamaduta, we sometimes laugh at this. What a nice story. What a nice story. Constantly feeding data and said, they did this, they did this, this, they did this. And there are files and files and files and files. Whether computer files or actual paper files, we don't know, but there are files. There are files and files and files of data talking about the sins of Jagai and Madai, which they say is gone into like a mountain. Mountain of sin. Right? And yet, Vinod Sagar says that Chand Rai and Raghavendra Rai were even more sinful. So we won't go into all that. Why? That's a different story. Being so sinful, constant meat eating, constant cow killing, constant blood killing, constant raping, constant drinking, constant everything possible you can do, degraded, everything going on. So sinful. Huh? But to take the story fast forward, to come to the point, what we're talking about. Raghavendra Rai gets transformed. At one point, he is so sinful that he is haunted by a Brahma Rakshas. The Brahma Rakshas is so powerful that tantrics are complete failure. In fact, he kills the tantrics. He's so powerful, the Brahma Rakshas is so powerful. He says, just get out, you guys. You know, I'm not going to get out from this person. And he torments and tortures like anything. And the father, Raghavendra Rai, is at wit's end with all the armies. He has an army of 5,000 fully armed soldiers with even kings could not attack. 5,000 strong army of fully armed, well-trained people who could fight any battle with any king. That's how powerful Raghavendra Rai was as a king of the dacoits. He doesn't know what to do with his son who is just completely in a suffering state. And then goddess Durga, he worships goddess Durga, and goddess appears to him and said, you know what,
is I am making this guy suffer so much. But he's been so sinful. He said, I have been worshipping you, mother. So this is worship? You think I eat all the flesh which you give me every day? Of all the flesh you give me? Anyway, I'm a Vaishnavi. I don't eat all this flesh. I said, what is the remedy for me? How do I really get rid of this? He said, only one person can do this for you. And his name is Narottam Das Thakur. Only he has the power to release you. Sangha. The Sangha process. The only people who can get help us rid of all our sins, sinful desires and tendencies, is close, not just association physical, but more we get connected with our hearts and minds, with the spiritual masters and the saintly devotees, that's the process of liberation. Tatam prasangam mama virya samvido. And the satams. Right? So, a pure devotee comes into the life for the first time. He has never associated with a pure devotee in his life. He's only associated with sinful people. And the moment he comes, the Brahmarakshas becomes completely, you know, amazed at the aura of his devotion. And he just becomes very peaceful. And there is no beating of the, you know, nothing of that sort, jhadna phudna. nothing is no mantra, no tantric, nothing is there, no limbu and mirchi, nothing of that sort, salt and nothing. He just comes in and just talks to the Brahmarakshas like that, directly. Just talks to him. He said, leave him. I order you, just leave this person alone. Release them from your bondage. He says, I am just so honored that you have come here, Narottam Das Thakur. It is my misfortune that I was in the body of this sinful Rakshasa-like person. But by seeing you, I am purified. Thank you for coming here. When I leave, the branch of that top tree will fall. And you will know I have left. It just leaves. The branch falls. And another comes to normal. Now the next thing is even more interesting. His previous enemies, he had tortured so many kings, and when he became subdued like a Vaishnava, very calm, quiet, humble, simple, gentle Vaishnava, he's arrested by his previous tortured king and put in a dungeon in a complete dark place with practically no air, no food, bound on ropes and slashed with whips, with salt on his body, made to suffer so bad. And yet, because it associated with Narottam Das Thakur and chanted the Maha Mantra, it does not lament. But heart is now filled with gratitude. And his father is so much in concern that my son is suffering, and he gets a mystic yogi who can enter into this cabin of the underground dark place and release him off through mystic yoga. He can just pull him out. He goes inside and said, hey, who are you? He said, I have been sent by your father. Please come. I will take you out from this suffering state. This is the climax. This is what happens to a person, or rather should happen to a person who has genuinely associated with this paradigm, with this concept, with this prescription of association with a pure devotee. He said, I do not want to come with you. I do not want to get released from this suffering. I will not take shelter of any mystic process. I will not take shelter of any mystic yogi. This is something very surprising. Imagine the situation that somebody is put into this hell and suffering emotional, physical torture of unprecedented degree, right? And with absolutely no hope that he will ever be released from this, and he will simply die in oblivion and become a carcass in an incarcerated place in a few days of starvation, dehydration, pain, bleeding, sorrowful, merciless death awaits him. And yet he has this shraddha, this conviction, that if I have taken shelter of pure devotional service, if I have taken shelter of a pure devotee, if I have taken shelter of the Maha Mantra, then I will not take shelter of anything but that. And he rejects them. Mr. Yogi said, get lost from here and don't show me a dirty face. Mr. Yogi is raising. This fellow must be mad. I have taken all the risk to come here and I can just release you off in 5 seconds and I can take you back to your father. Rejected. And he is in that place. And somehow or the other, we must be wondering, how did he ever get out then? This very, very demoniac Yavan king who was beating him every day to get his sadistic pleasures out of what he had gone through for the king. He was getting sadistic pleasure and beating him every day. And beating him mercilessly to death. But even would see the face of Chandrai, full of gratitude, full of forgiveness, no lamentation, nothing. That created a massive transformation in the Yavana king's heart. So I cannot imagine a person like this even exist in this world. I want to release you. I want to join my hand of friendship with you. He cuts off the rope, embraces him, and he has a handshake with him. He said, come out. And they become best of friends. That is the story. Seeing this Shraddha in the heart of Chandrai, the Lord in the heart of the Yavana king, created a change of his heart. In response to his unalloyed devotion to his spiritual master. This is the power of Shuddha Bhakti. This is what we can expect, that we do not take shelter of anything else. No astrology, no amulets in our arms, no Nag Bali and this and that. And sometimes all this sub-religious things may be there. We may get too attached to this, sub-religious principles about this and that. So many things are there which we may consider as Vedic. Yeah, they are Vedic, no doubt. But we are being urged. Naistrai Gunya Bhavarjuna. We've been urged to not rely too much on these sub-religious, shelter-giving, fallible soldier principles. We're being urged to take shelter only of two things: the saintly devotees of the Lord and the spiritual masters. And their example, their teachings, is the beacon light, the tower, the lighthouse tower, which guides our ship, our boat, in the right direction. And by doing that, we become free from all selfish desires. How? Because as Christ said, let not mine, by thy will be done. Thy will be done. Let not mine, but thy will be done. That means you are not anymore attached to your own selfish desires. Even in a devotional way, this may not be really the best thing to do. That means what it actually prompting towards more of group dynamics here. Because we can sometimes see that even in a project, which is a devotional project, if there is too much emphasis on one person and his desire is kept supreme, that is often lead to danger. But as Prabhupada said, you cooperate with your fellow devotees, right? And when a group dynamics works together, then there is less likelihood of one person's nature dominating the entire devotional project as well. And therefore it becomes even more selfless. Because it's not what I want, but what all of us want. Therefore the success is, because the success would come, it probably would intoxicate me with pride. But when the group dynamics works, when all Vaishnavas work together for some project, of course somebody may be the president, or somebody may be the in charge, somebody may be the, you know, HOD or whatever, he may take that role, but yet he's a servant leader, right? So when the group dynamics works, and when the success comes in, it is not going to lead to pride, but shared glory, shared success, shared happiness, right? And therefore it doesn't intoxicate you that I did it. Or if it doesn't happen, you don't get angry with somebody else who didn't properly. You don't get affected by anger, or don't get affected by lamentation. Oh, I couldn't do it. So in this way, even in a devotional project, these four things can still attack us in the milder form, not in a strong, but in a milder form. We must still be attached to selfish desires, lamentation, anger, and fear. But when a group works together, and that's the glory of Sankirtan. We'd all been urged to give up, even in a devotional society, desires which are very exclusive and specific only to me, and learn to work more as a group, as in a Sankirtan fashion, not only during Harinam, but in all our devotional endeavors. Whether it is in a family situation, we work like one team in the family, or it is Brahmachari Ashram, or it is a devotional endeavor and some group project activity, when we work in this way, we won't be attacked, the mind won't be intoxicated, it won't be affected, won't be infected rather, with these four principles which are definitely so heavy that they drag you towards the lower self. So, but if we really allow the higher principle to govern us, and that's what we've been learning in our bhakti process all these years. And when Mahaprabhu's kirtan, this is what is there. So Sankirtan activity is to be seen in a broader perspective. That glorifying Krishna together, and kirtan is a specific way of doing that. There are other specific ways of doing that also, right? So when we work together to glorify Krishna, to bring to fruition the desire of the spiritual master. Therefore we find Prabhupada, because of that connection, as this verse urges us, close Sangha, dissociated with material and associated with spiritual, because of that intense internal Sangha with his spiritual master, Prabhupada was able to overcome all the potential pride which could have affected him by such glorious success which nobody in the history of mankind had ever achieved. Because Prabhupada was immediately able to see within his consciousness, this is because of my spiritual master. He was not working as a solo person. So in spiritual life there is no room for I at all. There is never a I in spiritual life. Even if in a devotional way, it's I. No. I is always bad. I is always, 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 always bad. Because I is rooted in false ego. Right? And Prabhupada teaches us that it was not he, but it was we. It is my switch master who has done it through me. I'm the humble, simple servant. You could see Prabhupada was not affected at all. And that example is so powerful for all of us in our society to see that because he's connected so closely, and of course he didn't have saintly devotees, so in that sense, because he's a founder acharya, so he created saintly devotees. And then even then, when he created that, he said all of us work together. Now you create the GBC to work together. And even then he was supposed to putting himself sort of not in the forefront of everything. He said, all of you work together in this way. Prabhupada immediately installed a body of devotees to do it. Right? So he created saintly devotees and he was connected intimately with the spiritual master. And therefore, even glorious, unprecedented success kept Prabhupada very grounded in humility. What a beautiful example for all of us who get affected by small successes here and there with pride. Right? So, taking the clue from this particular sloka, the more we connect, and how do we connect with spiritual masters? By the process of simply hearing them with attention. When we hear them regularly, because in hearing, we get connected to their heart. Hearing from a pure devotee is not connecting to the sound vibration, because as the Switch Master speaks, what is coming from the Lord in his heart. So the process of hearing actually is so transcendentally beautiful that connects you not only to the spiritual master and to his desires, but actually connects all of us to Krishna, the source of all life. And therefore, to hear regularly from a bona fide spiritual master or spiritual masters, right, is the safest insurance for a practicing devotee, because then he can immediately connect his consciousness and what's happening within the realm of his consciousness as what is being said. When he connects these two, and he develops discrimination and eliminates selfish desires, eliminates all anger and fear, eliminates all lamentation, and comes to the transcendental position. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai.